This is an interview by Heather Campbell with Regimental Sergeant Major Henry John Butler on the 12th of November, 2008, at his home in Courtney.
I'm on a very little bit sooner than that, I don't know. But yeah. I've recently had, I'm still recovering from prostate surgery.
Okay.
So at times I have to move quickly.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Well, whenever you need to, that's completely fine.
But if I suddenly get up and disappear, you know
why. I know why. So, okay, now it's recording.
That's good.
And, yep, working. Okay, so, I guess we're going to start by me asking you, I know we covered this, but when and where you were born, and then a little about your family and where you grew up.
I don't know. I don't think we covered it before, but I was, I'm from England, and I was born in East London, suburb of East Ham, which makes me a Cockney. I was born within the sound of Bow Bell, so I'm a Cockney. Incidentally, the Bow is not the borough of Bow, but it's from the church of St. Mary le Bow. Mary the Beautiful. Anyway, and that's where I was born, and then my memory goes back. We were living in an apartment in Stratford, which is a bit further west. Then we moved to what was then a little country village called Hornchurch. It's now part of it was 14 miles from London. It's now part of the Greater London area. And that's where I grew up in. Sort of farming country, had a great time there. My first recollections of my father, we were just coming out of the depression of that era. He was luckily that he was in work during the whole of that period, but not very good. We were when we moved to Stratford, it was a sort of lower middle class area. Then prospects improved and we moved to Hornchurch and bought a house there which my parents lived in until almost the end, not quite. And from there I went to grammar school locally and then I joined the army. War came on. I tried to join the Air Force as air crew and they said yes, they'd accept me, but I have to wait on deferred service for 6 months because they got so many volunteers, and I wasn't happy with that. I was the youngest of a group of fellows and they'd all gone, so I put my age up 6 months, went next door to the army and said I wanted to be a paratrooper. And they said no, you have to join an infantry regiment first, and then when you had done your infantry training you can transfer to the paratrooper regiment, which is what I did. I joined a regiment known as the Rifle Brigade, did the training there, then I went to the parachute regiment and did my training and did the jump training at a place called Ringway near Manchester. And having done that, I was then posted to the battalion I spent the rest of the more or less active bit of the war with, the 7th Light Infantry Battalion. We members always stressed the Light Infantry because it was the only Light Infantry Parachute Battalion. The rest were all Navy Infantry blokes. And from there, we did the training, which was very hard, very tough training, which I successfully accomplished, and was part of the service battalion just waiting for D-Day to happen.
Did you... back to the training, did you have I guess all kinds of infantry training with the parachute training at the same time?
Yeah, well, once you're qualified parachutist, you're just expected to go and jump out of airplanes whenever they demand you do so. Other than that, it is just literally a means of getting you there.
Yeah.
After that, it is just ordinary infantry training you have to cope with. A bit harder and tougher in a parachute battalion because you have no transport. Everything has to be carried on your back. And you have to learn to march long distances with heavy loads. And being light infantry, we were expected to do it faster and quicker than any of the other battalions. And other than that, as I say, it's just pure infantry training. We were taught where regularly we were taught to handle German weapons, German machine guns, submachine guns, rifles, because very often on jumps people would lose their weapon, and the first time they got a chance to collar a German weapon, they did so.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you only had a rifle and you got the chance of collaring a German Spando MG-38, then yeah, you took it and used that.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, as I say, the parachuting bit was just a means of getting you there.
Mm-hmm. Was there something about the being in the air that it sort of intrigued you and that made you want to be a paratrooper, I guess?
No, I always wanted to fly. The finish of my schooling, I took an examination to become an aircraft apprentice, which is a boy entrant into the Royal Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
I took this in the August. The war broke out in September, and they cancelled the scheme there and then. And by the time they started it up again, I was too old.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my intention, was to join the Air Force as a boy entrant.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just the fact of being deferred for 6 months that put me off carrying on with my intention to join the Air Force.
Yeah.
And I was going to get into aeroplanes, so I became a parachutist.
Yeah. I read somewhere that they trained you as well to be pilots in...
No. You had the glider pilot regiment.
Mm-hmm.
And these were the big horser gliders. These mm-hmm. were chaps that were trained to fly those.
Mm-hmm.
And in a parachute, or in an airborne division, you had two brigades of paratroopers. That was three battalions of each brigade. And then you had a brigade of what we called glider riders.
Mm-hmm.
This was three battalions that came in these big horser gliders. And of course, they could cart in with them things like jeeps and trailers and anti-tank guns, the stuff that the paratroopers themselves couldn't cart in.
Mm-hmm. But they weren't interchangeable sort of
men? No, they stuck to their own. In fact, we got more pay. We got 2 shillings a day pay, and we were all volunteers. We're glider riders. They just decided to train a battalion to ride in gliders, and they got a shilling a day.
Mm-hmm.
So we were much better off.
And then did you have, approaching up to D-Day, when you finally found out that that's what you were intended for, were there many exercises to sort of simulate circumstances over there?
Oh, yeah, we knew all along that we were going to be used in the invasion of Europe. When it was going to occur, we had no idea. But as the date approached, yeah, exercises became more intense and more often.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we almost had a bit of a mutiny at one time. In this would have been about March, I think. We all got very bolshy. In fact, we were being worked on our feet 7 days a week and no breaks. And we had a very understanding colonel. More about him later. Very understanding colonel who realised that we needed some sort of R&R, rest. And he gave us a weekend off, which worked wonders.
Mm-hmm.
And this was must have been like Mrs. of April, because it was not long before D-Day, and it was a period when we weren't supposed to be getting short leaves. We were supposed to keep our nose to the grindstone.
Mm-hmm.
But, we did a lot of extra training, a lot of hard graft,
mm-hmm.
and several exercises actually jumping from aeroplanes. A lot of it was done without the aeroplane. You just assumed that we'd rock here, there, or everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, one thing about that, when you did a ground training exercise like that, you were all together. When you jumped from aeroplanes, you were scattered over Hell's Half Acre. And you had to run around finding one another and get to your rendezvous, and then from the rendezvous get to your objective. We seem to have been a bit better at that than the Americans were. they were scattered far worse than we were. There were two divisions of Americans in the west of Normandy. We were in the east, and one division of Brits. And they were good troops, good soldiers. We rather thought we were a bit better than them, and their organisation was better. Their pilots scattered them badly. No doubt about it. Our pilots were not so badly scattered. We didn't get so badly scatter us, but it was taking evasive action against anti-aircraft fire, the sort of put them a bit off their route. Hence, we got scattered too. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Did you have much? Did you meet up at all with the Americans? Did you have much interaction with them?
No, we were miles apart. They were right over in the Cherbourg area, and we were in the Caen area, completely miles apart.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that the exercises that you did helped you when you finally got over there? Like, were they useful?
Yeah, everything was sort of cut and dry. When a situation arose, you were already trained to take action on it. Mm-hmm. It was training was very comprehensive in this, and we were taught to accept the fact that we were going to be surrounded. There was no front or back, you know. Whereas the infantry, very often, if there's a chance of being surrounded, they would panic and get out of there. But we were taught to accept that fact and fight accordingly, which was quite a different sort of training and one which had to be repeated to get it. Mindset on the subject, mm-hmm. and so as I say, whenever in Normandy, when a situation arose, we generally felt that we'd already trained to cope with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. And then you had all your equipment with you. You were saying, I imagine it would have been quite heavy carrying everything on your back.
Oh yes, now particularly when you take. 3-inch mortar and Vickers medium machine guns. Like, for instance, I did a 3-inch mortar course, part of the training, up in the Welsh Mountains. Oh, it was hell. The mortar broke down into three parts, a barrel, the bipod, and the base plate. Each part weighed about 60 pounds. The idea was that if you carried one of those, the barrel's the most awkward part, it's just a little sling over your shoulder, but you carried the bipod on the base plate on a harness on your back, and on the front there were two 10-pound bombs to sort of counterbalance. And then the rest of the equipment that you would have carried as an ordinary infantryman, you carried that too, and a haversack slung around your waist. If you were just an ammunition carrier, you had a harness which had four bombs on the back, two bombs on the front, 60-pound weight, plus your equipment, plus your... Generally, the mortars and the machine gunners only carry four or five automatic pistols, whereas the rest was carried rifles and Sten guns. So, and then, well, being what it was, we also, when we knew where we were going, we also carried extra ammunition in our packs and things. So, the ordinary infantryman like I was, I carried a Sten gun with eight magazines. It was a bandolier fitted. Round eight magazines, so you could take one out, throw the one away that was used, and use the next one. And being my job in the section was a bomber, a house clearer, I carried two 4.36 grenades, which was a shrapnel grenade, big bang, lots of shrapnel. 4.77 grenade, which was a phosphorus grenade, and it instantly, when it went off, clouded the air in a white smoke, for cover. And I carried two 82 grenades. This was actually, we made it up. It was a cloth, like velveteen bag with a screw top on it. And in the bottom of the velveteen bag, you stuck a detonator, and then a gun cotton primer, and then you rolled up 2 pounds of plastic HE and shoved that in this bag, which had a elastic rod. And you unscrewed the cap off top, and when you threw it, there was a weighted tape on it. And as it went through the air, this tape unwound and dropped out. That was the safety, pulled out the safety pin. And when it hit, it went off with a big bang. And this was an anti-tank grenade. And we actually, killed a Mark IV tank and a self-propelled artillery gun on D-Day with these grenades. They were that efficient. And that was what I carried. I was well loaded up. Mm-hmm. Then the others carried different things like that. Majority of carried rifles. There was a Bren gun group with a Bren machine gun. There was a Lance Corporal in charge of that, and a gunner and a loader. It's the sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that you were trained in German weapons, so that if you lost yours when you landed, you would be able to use the weapons you found. Did you lose or have to get rid of your equipment at all because it was so heavy when you were trying to move quickly at all?
In actual fact, when we were making our way to the rendezvous after dropping, I had a kit bag on my leg when I jumped. It's a staple. It's a sort of special kit bag designed for that purpose. And when you got out of the aircraft and your parachute,
it was a kit bag specially designed when you got out of the aircraft. Oh dear, chump just fell off it. And your parachute developed. You pulled a quick release on your leg. That freed the bag from your leg, and you had 30 feet of rope you lowered down on that. And that was the sort of heaviest stuff we could carry. I had in this thing, I had two men's equipment. That is webbing and your pouches and your zippy pack. The other guy was carrying a rubber dinghy in his kit bag, so I had two men's kit. The dinghies was because when we got to the bridges, which was our objective, had they been blown up, we'd have had to make an assault crossing in rubber dinghies. Mm-hmm. There is the kit bags.
Okay. So quite large.
Oh, yeah. It takes a fair amount of gear. Mm-hmm. In theory, that was added a lot of weight to the parachute. The weight sort of drew the parachute in, and you might have dropped a little bit faster, but when that hit the ground, it relieved that amount of weight. In theory, the chute then breathed and opened up, slowed your own descent down.
Ah.
Well, that sort of worked, but that was the theory.
So once you were landed and got all your gear down and everything, take me sort of through what happened after that when you landed on D-Day.
Well, once I found the rendezvous, as I got there, there was a German motorcyclist come herring up the road, and he was tossing grenades as he went along. The German had two types of grenades. One was an egg-shaped grenade, just a tin case, unlike ours, which provided shrapnel. Theirs was 90% blast. Then he had the bigger thing, which was known as a potato masher. It was a round canister about the size of that coffee cup, and it had a wooden handle. And when he was ready to throw it, unscrew the cap at the bottom handle, and there was a marble there. And he grabbed hold of that and pulled it, and that set the fuse off. Then he got this thing, and it could be thrown a long way because of the design of it, the canister and this wooden handle about that long. It had a lot more bang to it. But anyway, I digress. And a bit further down the road, somebody blew this motorcyclist up with a Bren gun, a machine gun. And so that was sort of... when I jumped out of the plane, it was quite amazing. I was astounded by all the coloured lights that seemed to be creeping up slowly, then they flashed past and came to a dome. And there was this was anti-aircraft fire. The traces on the anti-aircraft rounds. Quite a pretty show it was, until I sort of clicked in very quickly that this was dangerous. The sooner I got down there, the better. When I landed on the RV, I dragged my kit bag to me, got the Sten gun out, loaded it, checked that there was no dirt got into it. At that moment, a chap ran up to me and said, "Are you one of us?" Luckily for him, I was.
Yeah.
Because he'd lost his rifle on the drop. He was our company clerk, as it so happened. Anyway, we eventually got to the RV. The motorcyclists went by. I got through the fence, across the road, and into a dell where we were. That was the RV, and people were gathering. And a major, I'm not sure who he was, which company it was, one of the company commanders, I'm not sure. It was dark. About 50 or 60 of us together, with us coming in dribs and drabs because of the scattering, and decided it was time we ran down the bridge, and he said he wanted a Sten gunner to go 30 yards ahead as a scout. I was a Sten gunner. I didn't say a bloody word. I wasn't going to volunteer, and he spotted... Enough light there, probably spotted my bandolier of magazines and said, "Oh, you, go ahead." So I took one of these grenades out, pulled the pin out, and held the lever so it was safe. And with the other hand, I got my Sten gun. And this is how I trotted for about a mile down to our bridge. When we got to the bridge, there were two bridges, one over the Orne River, which is a swing bridge, and the other one over the Caen Canal, which used to take ships from the sea, which is lifted up. When we got to the first bridge, the first thing I saw was a very young and very dead German with both legs blown off at the knee. Being the first one I'd seen, this sort of pulled me up sharp, and I'm looking at this, and the rest of the guys started rushing past me, so I automatically joined in, rushed down to the bridge, where I must have tossed that grenade, because I couldn't carry on carrying it without a pinion. I must have tossed it in the river as we went by. Trying to think. Anyway, when we got to the across the canal bridge, which was our objective to hold, this had been a group of the gliders had crash landed on this bridge. Three gliders on the canal bridge, three gliders, well, only two of which found the way there, on the river bridge. Their job was to crash land on it, capture the bridge, kill or take prisoner all the Germans that were on guard over the bridge, and hold it until we arrived, which we duly did, and our colonel arrived and took over the battle, and the glider riders were then placed in between the two bridges as a reserve. That was their job, to stay there, while we spread out from three villages, Lepore and Benneville down to Chateau de Benneville, which was at the south of us. And I immediately got my make it up with members of my platoon. We could see a fair about what was going on. The glider riders had shot and killed a half track. You know what a half track is? Instead of having four wheels, it's got two wheels at the front, and the back half is tracked. And it's good for cross country work. It's a half track, and it was armoured, and they shot it and killed it, and this was burning like fury. There's a bit of light to see, and we formed up. We were sent forward on a patrol. We got quite a distance from the bridge, and nothing happened, so we sort of settled down and waited till daylight. At daylight, a German patrol started coming the other side of the hedge from where we were, but twice as strong as us. We waited till it was at the right spot, and then we opened fire on it, obviously downed a few of them. And then they started firing back with the machine gun. We had cover from fire, from view, but not cover from bullets. they weren't quite sure where we were, but the machine gun was raking the hedge. One of our chaps got a bullet in the buttocks, got four wounds for the price of one in the buttocks. And we decided then it was time to withdraw. We withdrew down towards the bridge. And in my diary, I record about what I consider a very brave action of Private Mortimer. Mm-hmm. After that, we got back to the bridge, and we were split up. I was sent to the road between the Mairie at Benneville and Lepore, the road, a raised road, and I was sent down there to join people in B Company that were guarding and fighting for it, you know, whatever came along. There I had a fortunately there was also a chance for anybody that came on the road there with me and enfiladed from Lepore and from Benneville down the road, which was a great help to us. I had the unfortunate experience of having a Jerry come over this road all in a rush, and I was at the bottom of the slope, about 10-12 foot to the road. I was at the bottom of the slope, and he came over right above me, and I was leaning back with my Sten gun on my thigh, pointing upwards, and I just pressed the trigger, and he scared the daylights out of me, because it didn't seem to be doing anything, and I fired about half a magazine, two and a half seconds, that's all it took, that the bloke seemed to just stand there and not do anything. The guns went, and all of a sudden the magazine ran out and the chap came down on top of me. The bayonet on his rifle went into my thigh and out again. And the chap was quite dead, of course. The reason he seemed to stop up there was the bullets hitting him sort of held him up momentarily. And then that stopped. He came down on top of me. So I had a slight knife wound, that's all it was, in the thigh.
Was that your first main sort of combat with the enemy?
Well, no, first off, when we at daylight, when we bumped that patrol, I used up a couple of magazines from seeing and shooting at them. Mm-hmm. I said, we obviously knocked people down, but we don't really know what damage we did when they got the machine gun. Well, we got out of there pretty quick.
Mm-hmm. But
that's the first, the one and only, in fact, direct confrontation that I had at that time. Mm-hmm. After that, we moved back off the road to the next hedgerow, which gave us a better field of fire. And I then decided that I wanted to do something about this, stop it bleeding. And my equipment had got lost when we RV'd. I hadn't got any on. I hadn't got a water bottle. I was dying of thirst, so I decided to go down to the houses by the bridge, one of which we knew was a cafe. And I went down there and went into the cafe, and it was being used as a medical post for the chaps. And I went in there. Well, before I went in there, I stopped at the convenient place by a hedge, dropped my pants, got my field dressing out, fixed it around my thigh, and well trained. I was trained at first aid with the air raid precautions before I joined the army, and I got a bunch of safety pins, so I pinned this to my underwear so it wouldn't slip down. Then I carried on to the cafe. Asked the medic in there if he got anything to drink. He said no, you know, I'd knock on the door and ask the family inside, which I did do. And this little old man came out, badly in need of a shave. And I said to him, well, my best schoolboy French, have you got a drink of water? And in very good English, he said to me, don't drink water, I've got a real drink. And he disappeared back in again. A little while later, he came up with an armful of about 6 or 8 bottles, all muddy bottles of champagne. Put them on the counter, opened one, poured out a glass each, we toasted one another. Oh, before he disappeared, he kissed me. That stubbly cheek, that's what reminded me he needed a shave, he kissed me on both cheeks. And we had a drink of champagne. And prior to going into the cafe, I must backtrack, after bandaging my thigh and then going down towards the cafe, alongside the canal, a white scout car, it's not colour, it's a mate white, and it's like a one-ton truck, four-wheel drive truck, it's heavily armoured, quite heavily armoured, enough to stop small arms fire. And behind that was a Bren gun carrier, a small track vehicle. And in these two vehicles there was a sergeant and nine other Royal Engineers. They landed on the beach, kept off the road, and there's a sort of tramway rails all along the canal. They'd hit this and travel all the way down into our lines. Never saw a soul. Never had anything happen to them. They were the first people who got through to the bridge. And after a couple of minutes chat with them, they were there to survey the area, expecting the bridge to be blown. They were to survey the area for a Bailey Bridge. So I went in. Then I went to the cafe, and while I was drinking champagne, the corporal medic said he could hear pipes. Now the signal was when the commandos got through from the beach, they would play bagpipes, or their piper would play. So I grabbed half a dozen of the slips, 3 or 4 of these bottles of champagne, went outside, went to the doorway. Yeah, there was, my pipers were playing. A little later, German DD tanks. The DD were duplex, right? They were floating tanks. They were able to float. They took off landing craft and floated and had a propeller drive they drove in. That surprised the people on the beach, the fact that floating tanks arrived in at the same time as the infantry. The two of these turned. There was a T-junction from Le Port. We came down to the Mairie, then there was a T-junction that led down to the bridge. They arrived at the T junction. A couple of minutes later, round the corner came Lord Lovett, Brigadier Lord Lovett, who was the brigade commander of the commando brigade. There was a pipe on one side, blowing his cheeks out, and I presume his bodyguard on the other side. He came marching down the road. He didn't look like he'd had a wet landing. He wasn't carrying. In the film, The Longest Day, they got him dressed up in a big, heavy white sweater and carrying a sporting rifle. This was all bloody nonsense. That was the film. In fact, he was at a collar and tie on. The only arm he carried was a pistol in his holster, and he was carrying his swagger cane. And this is how he walked down towards the bridge and started across the bridge. The bridge was under sniper fire, and with a clang of bullets on the superstructure, he and his piper smartly got across and disappeared down the road. If he spoke to the famous Major Howell, I suppose he did, but I never saw that. They were out of sight. Then the commanders following started throwing smoke grenades and dashing across the bridge. Two or three of them got shot and wounded on the crossing when I was watching. And then I went up to the Mary, where the two tanks were, gave one of the tankers a bottle of champagne and opened some of the others and passed it round the commandos. The other thing they were looking for was a cigarette, because the Aston Dogman got there soaking wet on the sea landing. And I just had a lot of cigarettes. And then I was sent down to a bunch of others to try and relieve A Company, who were right at the south of Benneville, and they were cut off and quite severely depleted. And in my diary, I mention about, I was walking down through Benneville, and in my diary I mention other things, but mostly this was because I asked people the following day about it, because from there on, my mind is a complete blank. I just don't know what happened or what I did until this was probably about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And the next thing I remember, I'm in a ditch beside a road, and the gliders started coming in. There were two battalions landed on the east side of the bridge, and one battalion landed on the west side, right in front of us. And I remember them coming in, coming down, and a bunch of them, a company of them, I presume, formed up and put an attack in on a wood to our left where there was an attack had been forming up to come and attack where we were defending. And I don't know whether we got to A Company that were cut off, but we assisted A Company, and I don't know what I did. And the next thing I remember is going back up to the bridges just before midnight. And the infantry battalion infantry division from the beaches had got through and relieved us and took over the job of taking over the bridges while we went back and had a night's sleep after 21 hours of hard fighting. Mm-hmm. But for that period, I've worried my mind, I've tried hard, I don't know what happened. My mind is a complete blank. Mm-hmm. How one can not know what one did on such a traumatic experience, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But that's it.
Yeah.
From the time I was walking through Benneville with others, and incidentally shot out a few windows, because I was quite tight, I was on champagne, I was half drunk. From that time, everything became a blank, and I just don't know what happened until I remember the gliders coming in, then blank again until I'm back at the bridge. I joined up with the rest of my platoon again, and we went back across the other side of both bridges, and the idea was to dig in the field, dig a slit trench in the field for the night. Most of them did. I didn't. I just hit the deck and went. I was out. I slept solidly until daylight. Nothing happened. I was quite safe as it so happened. So there.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we go from here?
D-Day, I assume, was your first sort of action.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were you at all afraid going into it, or were you sort of hopped
not
up
really
on
curious, but rather than afraid? We've been well trained.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how well trained you are, you really don't know what you're up against, what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I felt no fear about what I was doing. Not only for D-Day, but for two or three days after, it was when we started getting artillery fire, quite a lot of artillery fire. I realised how much damage that artillery fire could cause, that I started getting frightened. But until then, adrenaline training carried one through with the knowledge that one was quite liable to get one's head blown off, but that was an accepted feature of what we were doing, what we'd been trained to do. You know, you accepted those odds.
Yeah.
And then later on, you began to think, you know, I want to survive this. So if there's artillery fire, I'm going to keep my head down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that ended D-Day, and then you were there for another about 30 or 40 days?
I spent
a
total of 40 days before I got wounded.
Mm-hmm.
After D-Day, we were outside the village of Ranville, R-A-N-V-I-L-L-E, my good French accent, Ranville. We were outside there for several days. In case of any attack coming up from Caen, where we knew there was more armoured troops. And at that spot, 3 days on the trot, Focke-Wulf or Messerschmitt, I'm not sure, plane came over and tried to bomb our bridge. In fact, they did hit it one day, and the bomb just bounced off, it didn't go off. Twice when we saw it come in the garden, and it came across our front, and twice when it came across our front, I had a shot at it with a Bren gun, miserably failed to hit it. The third day, my compatriot, whose kit I also lost, had a go, and he sort of sensibly started firing before the plane got there, and hosed it in, and the stream of tracer could be seen running right down the length of this plane, and it disappeared into the distance with a thin trail of smoke. We didn't down it, but we'd obviously hurt it. That pleased us no end. We spent about 3-4 days there, just under shell fire, nothing, we didn't see a German. We were then moved to the village of Heruviet, where we spent about a week. The next village, Escaville, a German fighting patrol moved into it, and we sent one of our companies in to take it back over again, and shot them up, took a few prisoners, and had one or two walking wounded, fortunately. Meantime, I was a spectator of this. We were still in our positions at the south of Heruviet, waiting for any German attack that came into the direct of the village, which never did. And then, after about a week there, we moved to the woods, the Bois de Bavon, the Wood of Bavon, a very dense woody country with open fields in amongst it. And we took over from the 8th Battalion, who'd had quite a pasting there. And we sat there doing fighting patrols, of which I got involved in one. Got fed up with sitting on my backside in the hole, so I volunteered to go as protection to a patrol of snipers. And then we were there for a week, 10 days, and got moved back for a week off, a week rest, back to the River Orme. There was a field there which had been made a sort of rest area for, so they were rotating the troops, the battalions, and we had a week there, then went back to the Bois de Bavon. During this time, with various patrols and things, we moved forward several hedgerows. And the Normandy hedgerow is a terrible thing to fight around. It is a bank about 6 or 8 foot wide, 6 to 8 foot high, with heavily treed and bushes on the top. And ideal ambush country for anybody that's outside. We moved forward between the two battalions about 3 hedgerows by the time we returned back there this time. And over the next field, about 200 yards away, there was another one of these bocage hedgerows, and on our left behind it was a big farmhouse, which we christened Bob's Farm. And the CO decided we had to take this out. And so they bombarded it with another company, B Company, other C Company. B Company was laid on to attack this, and C Company were to give covering fire. They were to attack the farm, and then move down to from our left to our right, throwing smoke grenades as they went. And all that time, we were to give covering fire along the German line in front of the throwing smoke grenades. And we were given extra automatics. They brought Vickers machine guns down. I was given a Spandau 38 with 5,000 rounds of ammunition. And in the meantime, they bombarded it with a Piat. A Piat was a projector infantry anti-tank. It was an anti-tank weapon, but if instead of aiming it directly, you sort of laid it on a monopod, you laid it back and shot like this, you could drop bombs about 150, 200 yards away onto a building. They refer to it as a housebreaking rule. In the meantime, they put about a dozen rounds on this to shake, weaken the farm and shake it up anybody that was there. Then B Company went into attack, and then we opened up with our guns, and the artillery opened up on us. And at that time, I was at the edge, in a pit, on the edge of the, on top of the bocage, on the forward edge, with the Spandau shooting over the lip of the hedge, firing away happily. And they had these, Joan had these six-barrel rocket mortars. They were known as moaning minis because they made a terrible screaming sound. And no matter where you were, you felt like they were coming directly at you, even if they landed miles away. You felt, and they were firing these, and a batchman came over, and one hit, landed on the front of the hedgerow, right below the barrel of my gun, which sent me and the gun backwards. The gun actually, barrel of the gun actually creased my steel helmet, and I got a piece of shrapnel in my hand, which wasn't much, but it looked a bloody mess at the time. And a chappie next to me, who was standing up, had been firing around the tree and firing a rifle, looking for opportune targets, and he had both legs practically cut off by this same bomb, piece of casing hitting. Somebody was out there sort of, I was in a hole with the head down, and somebody was out there sort of putting tourniquets on him and called me to come and help. And I didn't want to get out of the hole, I was shaking. And eventually I got out, and the chap looked at me, blood dripping blood, and he said, "Oh, you want to get somebody else," which I did. And then somebody wrapped some bandage around my hand, and I then ran to get the stretcher bearers at the company HQ, which is about 200 yards back. We had a heavy hill shellfire, but I still ran. And I got to company headquarters, told the stretcher bearers they were needed. The bloke had lost his legs, who incidentally was sitting there looking quite comfortable, holding two tourniquets onto his stumps. And then, having started moving, I decided I wanted to move further, and I ran them back to another 400 yards to the battalion headquarters where the medical officer was, and got seen to by the medics. And the medical officer, in his wisdom, decided to send me back to the casualty clearance centre further back, and from there I went to a field hospital where for 2 days I was under drugs, didn't know a damn thing for 2 days. I was later. At the end of that 2 days, they brought me round, bandaged up my hand again, cleaned it up, and took me up, put me on a hospital ship. Back I went to England. Mm-hmm. Landed up in hospital at Winchester. And that was sort of my short, sweet D-Day history. Oh, Normandy history. Mm-hmm. Any more questions?
I have a few, but did you... Okay, are you good to go? You don't want to take a break at all?
No, it's all right. Carry on.
Okay. You mentioned, just going back a little bit, that you were bored of sitting around, so that's why you went on to the patrol. Yeah. Was it quite sort of boring being an infantry soldier, I guess?
Other than there's sort of three situations, I think. One is the boredom, being liable to attack with nothing happening, and you're sitting under cover. The other is fear, when you're under artillery fire, and it's heavy and it's causing casualties. And the other is when you're in an attack and you're boosted with adrenaline and you think of nothing but your objective. Adrenaline sort of carries you through. So you've got those three sort of feelings. And where we were there, we'd been for, I don't know, about a week, sitting on our backsides in the bottom of a slit trench. Sometimes nothing was happening, then all of a sudden you'd have 15 to 20 minutes of heavy shell fire. The longer period was just sitting there bored. In fact, I got an old bicycle as a change, but I leaned it against the trail and I used to sit on this bicycle and write letters home just to get out of the hole. Mm-hmm. Next to it says I could dive in.
Yeah.
And so they wanted a... They were sending out three snipers to sort of go through some of the denser parts of the wood where we used to slip through behind Jerry lines, and they used to send patrols through our lines and through these dense woods. The idea was to find the three snipers to find a likely spot and split up, and they already had a fire plan, so that when they fired, nobody knew whether it was coming from here, there, or where it could be. Two shots in this area, one shot from that area, the next shot was in that area. That was the idea. With a same gunner as local protection in case anybody sort of came along behind them. Mm. And that was, they were looking for a same gunner, and I decided that I was bored stiff to go with it. I was sorry afterwards, I had done, because we got mixed up with the artillery fire from both sides where an attack was laid on by our people, which we knew was going to happen, but we were too long out in no man's land sort of thing. But eventually we got back to mm-hmm. our own spot. And I didn't volunteer again after that.
It cured your boredom, did it?
Yes. I accepted the boredom.
Are you on a break area? I have made some
because
I've got to have my lunch
because
I've got an appointment.
Okay, yeah, we can break now if you want
to. Sure. So we're back again.
Good. Hello, how do you do? Had a good lunch.
It was an excellent lunch.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we ended off. You finished telling me about your patrols and how that was the last one.
I volunteered for it. Last volunteering, I think, yeah.
You mentioned earlier that you used to sit on the bicycle and write letters home.
Yeah.
Did you write home very often?
Fairly often, yeah. Actually, I wrote some letters which my mother greatly appreciated, and which I was a bit soft about saying, I thought perhaps I might not go get back there, so I'd write down a few thank yous that I'd never made when I was living at home.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I wrote fairly often.
Mm-hmm. And that was by post?
Everything was... unsealed, went to company headquarters, and an officer went through it to see there was nothing that shouldn't be there, nothing in there that shouldn't be in there, and if there was, he just used a blue pencil or used a razor blade, cut it out.
Yeah.
Censored it. And then off it went. We didn't, at that stage, we didn't have to pay postage or anything, it was just sent.
Mm-hmm.
That and a girlfriend I had at the time, I used to write to her occasionally to...
Yeah. And then did you get letters from your family at all?
Very few. But the time when they started coming through was not long before I copped it, so I've got very few back.
Yeah.
In fact, the girlfriend sent me about a dozen magazines. They never arrived to me.
Oh. Yeah, so I guess not a very quick system when you were over there.
Well, it was all right once it got going, but things were like... Man, a lot of that treated very seriously, but in the forces, particularly in wartime. Well, they were pouring everything into that Normandy bridgehead, which was very tight, and they hadn't got room for everything, and they had to wait until they expanded the fighting, took it out and expanded, opened up the bridgehead, and they could bring other things in.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably a thing like a postal unit. It got very low priority amount, compared to men and ammunition and food. You know. So, yeah, it took a bit of time to get it established, but once it was established, the Army post office system was very, very good.
Oh, well, okay. And the longer you spent on over in Normandy, did you find yourself becoming hardened at all to the events that were going on, sort of the fighting, and did you sort of just block it out, or did you?
I don't think you ever get hardened to it. As I said, you've got three things. You've got boredom, you've got fear, and you've got adrenaline rush.
Yeah.
And they each take their turn of of your feeling. But, yeah, you get more experienced. The more experience you get, and the more used to, you eventually do get used to it to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for instance, that... if artillery lands just past you, you're not going to get anything coming back at you. It all shoots forward in the original direction it was going. Even if it explodes, 90% of it goes straight forward. You learn that things like that, that you're, if it lands behind you, you're quite safe. Just ignore it.
Yeah.
But you never really get hardened to it.
No. Yeah.
It's always there. There's always, at some time or other, there's always the fear, and at other times there's always the adrenaline rush that carries you through.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, it's sheer boredom.
Yeah.
It's, the majority of the time is taken up with sheer boredom.
Mm-hmm.
Waiting for something to happen and hoping it doesn't.
Yeah. So, you mentioned back when we were talking about the training that you had a colonel that at Ringway, that was very, or a commander at Ringway.
No, we did a parachute training at Ringway, but the colonel was CR the battalion that I got sent to after I was qualified as a parachutist.
Yeah, but he was the one that you said gave you the leave right before you.
That was nothing to do with Ringway. That was well after Ringway. That was after we'd been trained as parachutists and had been doing a lot of training for D-Day.
Oh, so the training for D-Day happened after, it wasn't at Ringway.
No, at Ringway you just qualified as a parachutist.
Oh, okay.
And once you were qualified, you were sent to a battalion.
Okay.
And then once you got to the battalion, you started training for D-Day.
Mm-hmm. And that was at the base that you had been stationed at?
Yeah, that was at a place called Bulford.
Okay.
On Salisbury Plain, which was an ideal spot for dropping us when we did exercises requiring an actual parachute descent.
Mm-hmm.
That was a dodgy thing too at times. We trained on several aircraft. The famous one which was used, what the Americans used, nothing but, we used quite a lot of them, was the DC-3 Dakota, Douglas Dakota. And there was another aircraft, twin-engine aircraft, which only took 12 men, called an Albemarle. And then my battalion did most of the training on a Stirling bomber, four-engine bomber, which was great. You could put 28 men in it, and they had a hole in the floor, bigger than the seat of that just as you're sitting on it. It's
mm-hmm.
a big hole.
Mm-hmm.
And you, when the green light, you were ready to go, and then the green light went on to say jump, and you just saw 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and you just literally, the bloke at the back ran down, get out. And that was fine,
mm-hmm.
but there were dangers to it. One practice jump we were doing, we were all stood up, ready to, waiting for the green light to go to start jumping. And the plane seemed to hit something in midair and almost stop, and then carried on again. And we nearly all fell over, and we all got up and rushed. We were worried about what the hell was that, you know, so we rushed out as quickly as we could, quicker than usual.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until afterwards we found out that the preceding plane, our one had come in a bit lower than he probably should have, and the preceding plane, which had dropped people, they were still coming down. An airplane hit two of them, and of course killed them.
Yeah.
And it hit two of them, and the shock was such, it didn't hurt the plane, that took it off, but the shock was such, it took us off our feet and frightened the life out of us.
Yeah.
And then two or three planes were shot down on the drive to Normandy, with the people inside, those that were still in it when it went down were killed. Two planes in particular, which had a mixture of my battalion people and some Navy people and some Royal Engineers, which they were shot down, and something like six or eight people survived of one of them, and they were taken prisoner by Jerry, who then later took them outside the chateau where they were and killed them, shot them. Cold-blooded murder.
Mm-hmm.
There was one fellow and one of the aircrew survived, and people in the district were able to tell the tale of what happened on that. So Jerry didn't always play the game.
Yeah. Did you have, how did you feel toward them? Like, did you have sort of...
animosity?
Yeah.
Not really. They were on the other side, that was all.
Yeah.
And it was our job to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
As quickly and as efficiently as we could.
Yeah.
But, you know, we took prisoners, and as far as I was concerned, as far as all our troops, I'm sure, were concerned, they were out of the war, and we treated them as such. We'd give them cigarettes and things like that, send them back. Surprisingly enough, it was the people further back that didn't do the actual fighting that gave prisoners a hard time, very often.
Yeah.
It's the way of the world, isn't it?
And, let's see where we are here.
I'm going to say bye-bye to you.
Oh, okay.
Okay, we'll meet again.
It was wonderful to meet you. Yes, I hope so.
Well, next time you're up
next time I'm up here, I'll stop by.
Yeah, okay. Right. Sorry I've got to dash off.
Oh, no, thank you very much for lunch.
Thanks for getting this lunch off.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'll see you when I get back.
Yeah, I guess.
And then, so did you feel the work you were doing over there was important, or was it just sort of at the time you were in it and it was...
It was important. We knew that the invasion was the quickest way to stop the war, end the war.
Mm-hmm.
So it was important. We had no doubt that the invasion would be 100% success. That was the mindset. We were sure it was so well organised, and it was so well organised, right down to the toilet paper, that we were sure that it would be 100% success.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, and the whole group, us and all the infantry and armour, it was hard going to expand the bridgehead. But once they got going, it was, as I say, it was the quickest way to end the war.
Yeah.
Russia's one side, us the other side,
mm-hmm.
going to meet in the middle.
Yeah. After that, you were sent back to England and you were at the hospital in... Rochester?
I'm going out the back door. It will be unlocked.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll look at you.
At the hospital, were you happy to go back home at that point?
Too right, I was. Yeah, we'd have been blasted a bit too. In fact, I went to two different hospitals, and then they sent me back to my regimental depot, and I was sent to on a medical board. And the medical board, I was marked down as, old age memory is a terrible thing, severe blast trauma. It was marked down as an injury, severe blast trauma. And I was medically downgraded for 12 months, which effectively put me out of the fighting war.
Mm-hmm.
Because 12 months later, the war was over.
Yeah.
So... I wasn't going to grumble with that. I felt a bit guilty of the fact that I was, with no real physical injury, that I was put out of the war while my friends were still in it and probably getting killed or maimed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I did feel guilty about that, but what can you do? You accept that that's mm-hmm. the luck of the draw, if you wish, or the way the cookie crumbles.
Mm-hmm.
For the rest of my war, at the regimental depot, I was trained as a pay clerk.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went, we had various aerodromes around the country which were set up to literally take battalions of paratroopers and fly them across to wherever they were going to go. Fortunately, at that stage, they were never used for that purpose, but the one I was on was used at one stage to quickly fly several thousand troops from England over to France whenever badly sorely needed at reinforcements. And we had the main drone, it had been an American bomber drone, but no longer needed. They were over at the transport drone, the Dakotas actually. They were over in France, they moved over there, so it was no longer used as a drone by them. Mm-hmm. But we took it over. We had three places which were Nissen huts for accommodation. We put troops up in there for 24, 36 hours, 48 hours. And then they were taken down to the airfield and flown across to France. Mm-hmm. And I was there when war was declared over. Mm-hmm. And that's where I met my future wife. Not at that time, not until late, 9 years later that happened. But I was actually going out with her cousin at the time. And she was a lot younger and used to spy on us, little devil. But then 9 years later I was in the village and I came into contact with her through her aunt. And it went from there, and we eventually got married.
Well, a happy ending.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the 7th Light Infantry, or in the sort of group as a greater whole, how was the camaraderie? Did you have good comradeship with the soldiers that you were with?
You built up, generally, you knew your own platoon, which was 30 men. You knew the others in the company quite well, but not greatly. The other two companies, the headquarters, you hardly knew anybody in it. You were a little entity. Within the platoon you had your certain personal friends, but as a whole, we were a group that got on well together, played silly buggers together and things like that, such as there was a cast iron stove in there, and one day somebody threw a grenade inside it. We all dashed out the doors, the windows, everywhere, while it blew the cast iron stove to pieces. Sort of stupid pranks that you do when you're that age, and which could kill people, but you don't think about that. as an entity, we got on very well. Two personal friends were the one I mentioned, Brennan, who's the other one was a chap named Patterson, who was also medically downgraded through wounds. He got quite badly, one leg badly smashed up. While the war was still on, he decides to get married and I was his best man. We were both in England at the time, so I was his best man. And I managed to, once computers came in, I managed to cotton onto him, find out about him and Brennan, and we used to converse with one another. And then one of the Lance Corporal, remember I said a brain gun group had three men, a Lance Corporal and two men. The Lance Corporal in my section, I got into contact with four or five years ago. He's living in Jersey. And we did a three-way interview, he and I, on the BBC. And they recorded our interview and played it over the air. Computers are wonderful things.
They are. It's amazing what you can do now. Mm. Do you think that your sort of strength and comradeship in your group there affected your morale at all?
Yeah. This is one of the things that carries you through when you're scared to death. You're not going to let yourself down in front of your comrades. Mm-hmm. So you pull up with it, get on with it. Mm-hmm. And this is a general feeling that pervades the whole group. Your loyalty to your comrades and supporting your comrades as they support you is paramount. And this literally carries you forward when you're frightened to death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. It's amazing. I don't think I've ever...
You've never been under that circumstance.
No.
Your life's at stake, possibly, or serious injury is at stake, and you'd like to stay put and not stick your head out. Mm-hmm. You know full well that your comrades are going to do it, so you've got to do it in support of them.
Yeah.
they would do it in support of you, yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Camaraderie, wartime camaraderie is something different. You never get it in peacetime.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why so many old comrades' associations, where they can get together and remember their wartime camaraderie.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I can't do that with my own regiment, either the airborne or the rifles, because they're in England. But there was this one and only Canadian Parachute Battalion, the 1st Canadian Parachute Battalion, and who fought in our division. And the association over here, they decided a long time ago when they formed it that all immigrant Brits who were airborne, it didn't matter which division they were in, could become associate members, or honorary members, whatever, associate members. So that is my only link now in my wartime camaraderie, is with the members of survivors of One Canberra.
Yeah. When the war ended, and even now, do you miss that at all? Is it?
No.
No?
It was more joy and celebration than that with VE Day, was to be clear.
Yeah. But I mean, having that sort of, I guess, close link with those people,
I did have, to a degree, in England. I used to go to reunions there in England, but
yeah.
It was once I left England, that was all over there. So the only link I have with airborne is 1st Canadian Parachute, though I wasn't with them in Normandy, I wasn't with their battalion fighting. I was in the same area as they were in.
Mm-hmm.
They were all part and parcel of our organisation.
Yeah.
And we've got a lot of memories, joint memories,
mm-hmm.
of what we did or what we didn't do.
Just to go back a little bit, when you were, I guess being an airborne division, when you were dropped in and you were surrounded, did you ever, you mentioned in your diary that you had to go quite a long time without, and even here you mentioned to go a long time without food for?
Yeah, well, we had rations in our pack for 48 hours, but they got lost on the DZ. We had to, the idea was we dumped all our kit for the sake of speed to get down to the bridge, and we sorted out later. In actual fact, Jerry sorted it out later and had all my cigarettes and chocolates and rations. So the whole of D-Day, we had nothing at all to eat.
Mm-hmm.
The following day, we had in our pockets a tin of an emergency ration, not only to be opened on the instructions of an officer. Oh, to hell with that, we were hungry, so we opened it, and it was a square of very dense, dark chocolate. It was good, and it was nutritious. It was full of calories and protein. It was bitter, but it was good. And that's all I had for the second day. So I had a meal in England on the 5th, in the evening of the 5th. I had nothing on the 6th. I had this tin of chocolate on the 7th. And then on the 8th, I had a breakfast. Some of the rations had come through, and I had a breakfast of fried bacon. I remember fried bacon and biscuits. Oh, and links, sausage links, soya sausage links. There's no meat in them, there was soya flour. So I had fried bacon, soya links, and Artek biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
That was on the 7th, which was the first meal I'd had since the real proper meal since the evening of the 5th.
Mm-hmm.
Food. Are you interested in our food?
I am interested in our food.
Right. We had what was called, on the assault, we had 24-hour ration packs, which contained condensed things like there were biscuits, there was sweets, sugar for energy. There was a condensed sort of porridge, oatmeal biscuit, which you could make up as oatmeal or just eat it and have drink water, fill it up. And there was dehydrated meat, which is terrible. And that was a 24-hour pack. And then once you got over that, you were not expected to use that for longer than 48 hours. That's why we had two of them in our packs. The next thing came along was a thing called 14-man packs. Now, this was a wooden box packed with all sorts of goodies, and it was meant it would last one man for 14 days or 14 men for one day. And that was the red basis it was dished out on. And in each of these packs, there was two tins of 50 cigarettes, that was 100 cigarettes, So that meant 7 cigarettes a day per man, which is a freebie, which is good. And then the tin food, the canned food, was really, really good. There was steak and kidney, not particularly liked by North Americans, Canadians, or Yanks, but loved by the British. Steak and kidney puddings, Irish stew, meat and vegetable, all sorts of goodies like this. Very, very tasty. And then there was a dessert. It was Christmas cake. The best rice pudding I've ever had in my life. Canned peaches. It was interesting. There was biscuits. There were sweets. Cans of cheese. Cans of margarine. These were sort of snack foods. And generally when we were sitting around with nothing to do, we'd always have some a can of margarine or tin of cheese there and some biscuits, and we'd sit there and plaster margarine all over the biscuits and bits of cheese and give ourselves a snack. Mm-hmm. Really the boredom. And what else is in those packs? Well, there were, as actual fact, there were 7 different packs. 6 of them were hot meals, and the 7th one was a cold meal. It was canned corned beef and tinned vegetables, and that could be eaten cold. Not a popular pack at all, but it was an attempt to sort of change the diet around. But in the main, when you were in it like we were in a fairly static position for the period I was with them, cooks at battalion headquarters would break open these packs, sling them all in big dipsies, called they used to put them in insulated boxes called hay boxes, and they'd put some water in, stir it all up, cook it up, heat it up so it's all boiling hot, and they'd send the hay box down to the companies, and there was 10 gallons in each one of these, so there's 10 gallons of stew. And then we used to use biscuit tins, which we soon acquired, and somebody would meet a platoon, or each section would go up with his biscuit tin and get the platoon or section's rations of stew, and it was still hot by the time we got it. We used to have a mess tin full of hot stew at least daily, at least once a day. When it was breakfast meal, we had this bacon, and we had these oatmeal biscuits. At one stage they were making it up, they made very good oatmeal porridge. The milk and sugar was all included in the packet. And tea was the other thing. You relied heavily on tea. Hot tea was a great nerve steadier, I suppose you call it. Mm-hmm. They used to say the British Army in World War II fought on cups of tea. The armoured people, whenever they stopped, they used to jump outside, take their brew can off the back of the armoured car or a tank, and have a brew up there and then, you know. And that's how we fed. It was high protein, very rich, lots of fats in it, and, but it went down very well. And I've liked stew ever since. Yeah. So we were quite well fed, sometimes a bit erratically. For instance, when we were... The day I got injured, there's one thing. The CO decided that we were all going to have... I never thought of it before. It might sound rather like feeding the condemned man before he gets to the block. Because he made sure that we had a hot early meal that day. Because we were also probably going to be involved in fighting when the proper meal time came round. So a very thoughtful CO, but he made sure we all had a hot meal before the attacking started. Mm-hmm. Greatly appreciated. So yeah, food was good. It was more than adequate. We enjoyed it. And I could live on it forever. Mm-hmm. Because troops out there in the main did live on it for months on end.
Yeah. And even when you were moving, though, and you weren't sort of stationed, you never had any sort of great length of time where you were without or short?
Yeah, it was, you know, if you move forward, the cook had to move forward, and had to set up in a hurry and cook the stuff in a hurry and get it in hay boxes. Once it was heated and put in these hay boxes, they were big insulated containers. They called them hay boxes because in the early days, like on the Indian frontier, they used to have wooden boxes, and they put the dixie in and stuffed hay all the way around as an insulator. So these things, though, they were made proper insulating containers, were known as hay boxes. Mm-hmm. And once it was all cooked and heated up, put in those hay boxes, it would stay hot for several hours.
Oh, okay.
So the cooks might have been quite a way back, but they'd get it done and then carry it forward to wherever you were.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the only time it was inappropriate was when there was that very fast dash after the breakout after the Falaise pocket, very fast to the, towards the German border, where the tanks were grinding away doing 100 miles a day sort of thing. Then they would send up just the cans, unopened cans, and you just had to open them up and eat them cold.
Yeah.
It was satisfactory as a short-term thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No problem. I was quite happy to eat it cold too.
Yeah. and going back, you were a volunteer, and you joined up, but what were your reasons for joining? I don't think we covered that, did we?
It was a war on.
Yeah.
We were all intensely patriotic.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I was going to go. I was quite happy to go and join up sooner or later, but being the youngest of a group, my friends, my mates had all gone. And I was getting funny looks because they had all gone and I was still there. People didn't know what age I was, but they didn't. They thought I was sort of chickening out. So that made me put my age up 6 months. And I craftily, we all carried identity cards during the war. Everybody had an identity card. And on the back of it was a stamp and it was filled in and gave you date of birth. And I altered my date of birth from 6th of June, 1625, 1st of June, as you say. I altered it from 1625 to 11125, so it put my age up 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
It looked a bit dodgy, but nobody ever queried it. They were only too pleased to get you in.
Yeah.
And I went and joined up. It's as simple as that. But, I mean, we all, at that stage, I was still at school when the war broke out, but we all knew that sooner or later, if the war carried on, we'd be in the forces.
Mm-hmm.
I went in the army, another one went in the army, two went in the Royal Navy, one went in the Royal Indian Navy, believe it or not, and one was air crew in a Halifax bomber, and he went right through without a scratch, luckily for him. And that was this whole little group of us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I know you mentioned earlier, but for the record here, did you have any family connection with the military? Did anyone else in your family?
Well, yeah, there was. I had one uncle who was a Royal Marine. He started off in the First World War, and he was in the Marines for 33 years. And when he finished with that, he was a cook. When he finished with that, he became a cook on the Union Castle line, going from England to South Africa. And he died aboard ship, and they buried him in South Africa. And I had another uncle who spent 35 years in the Royal Army Pay Corps.
Mm-hmm.
Hence, my older brother was told to, before World War II started, but when it was obvious it was going to happen, and my uncle convinced my eldest brother the best thing he could do was to join the Royal Army Pay Corps Reserve, so he'd be called up in a non-combatant outfit when the war started, which duly happened.
Mm-hmm.
The other brother, the middle brother, he was already in a territorial army unit. He joined that as soon as he was old enough, and so he was called up about a week before Action 4 actually was declared.
Mm-hmm.
He had quite a war. He was all set up to go to Norway and that collapsed, so they turned around and they sent him out to Egypt for the Desert War, and he fought right the way through the Desert War. From the desert he went into Sicily and then into Italy. He was one of the famous desert rats. You've heard of the desert rats? Oh, you haven't got much military history behind you. And with the 7th Armoured Division, they were known, probably the most well-known armoured division in the British Army, called the Desert Rats. They were called this because their desert sign was a jaboa, which was a little rat-like, it was a rodent, which sort of sat upright, looked rather something like a kangaroo, would have sat upright, with a long, thin tail with a bushy end to it. It's called a jaboa. This was their sign, and it was also known as the Desert Rat, so they became the famous Desert Rats. So they went right through Sicily, Italy, and then they brought the whole division, halfway up Italy, they brought the whole division back to England to go on to Normandy.
Mm-hmm.
And he landed in Normandy on D plus one, second day. And all that time he'd never had a scratch, and then they were driving along what they thought was a cleared road, cleared from
tank mines.
Just after the Falaise pocket, they were sort of looking to find where Jerry had got to, and they went over a mine, killed the colonel, and smashed my brother's faces, which they repaired amazingly well. Hardly noticeable when they finished with it. Surgery became very good towards the end of the war. You know, they learned as the war went on. Mm-hmm. Became better and better.
Mm-hmm. And did the family connection or having people in your family in the military, did that influence you to join at all?
I don't know. I don't think it had any real bearing on it, except that I knew they were there, and I probably thought, well, you know, they had a good life in the army, I might as well try it. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I intended to stay in the army after the war and make my regiment my regular regiment for the rest of my service, which mm-hmm. I did.
Yeah.
So probably there's some influence on that thought without me even thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Just sort of there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uncle Sam and Uncle Bill, well, they were in there, they did well. Well, I don't know what the hell I'm going to do when I come out of the army, so I might as well stay in the army. Simple as that.
Yeah. And this is your first time away from home, was it?
Yes, so it was. When I was first joined up, I went to the city of York, which is our trading area. The amusing part about that was at the back of the barracks there was a large training field where we used to train and do exercises. This was January, February, and it was wet and muddy. And alongside there was a lunatic asylum. And they all used to line up on the veranda and watch our silly buggers traipsing. They were in the war. We were traipsing around in all the mud and wet. Oh, we just wanted to do with men, them or us. So you did your first 6 weeks training there, after you were inducted and kitted out with urinal. And the first 6 weeks training there, which was mostly drill, which was considered necessary, and still is, a means of getting you to obey orders when you don't really want to. It becomes automatic. You're drilled and drilled and drilled until, bang, an order becomes automatic. Mm-hmm. And it works, believe me. And then from there on, I went to a place called Retford in Nottinghamshire, which was the main training battalion. It was known as the Motor Training Battalion. And there we were taught infantry tactics, handling of infantry weapons. I was taught to drive a Bren gun carrier. I wasn't really, because I already knew how to drive a Bren gun carrier. I'd worked on building them in Civvy Street, driven them. But and you've got this training, and once that is complete, you would be sent to a service battalion, which at that stage would have meant going out to Egypt. But instead, that was when I volunteered to transfer to the parachute regiment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's when we started back from where we were taught.
Yeah.
Hard work at Hardwick Hall in Chesterfield, and then when I say bang orders works, it really does work, because when you got to Ringway, you did a lot of ground training. Our initial jumps were from the barrage balloon, which had a cage on the bottom with a big hole in the middle. And five blokes used to sit round the hole, and an instructor was there. Now, for the first week you're there, you're training for half of the day. You spend climbing up onto this mock carriage, sitting down, and the instructor shouts at the top of his voice, "Action stations, go!" And you push yourself up and jump through the hole into a pile of mattresses down below. And you're doing this for hours for the first week. Bloody silly, this is done. You said you've got to say next, and you go. When you get up there on the first time and you jump, and you're sitting on the edge of this hole like that, with nothing between you and the ground, except hopefully that thing on the back's going to work, and he suddenly shouts, "Action stations, go!" And it's a reflex action. You obey the order because you've been drilled into you. Just, I remember the thought in my mind was, "You silly devil, what'd you do that for?"
Yeah.
And that's how you do your first jump. It's a reflex action from mm-hmm. all that ground training, monotonous ground training, drilling it into your head. Mm-hmm. And drilling on the barrack square gets you drilled to obey orders. And when you're in a battle situation and you might get your head blown off, you still obey orders. Automatically. Not quite automatons, but very near it, you know.
Yeah. Which I guess is important when, you know, you can't let fear get in the way.
Yeah, that and the fact that, you know, I don't want to do it, but my mates are going to do it, and I'll let them down.
So, were you going to say something?
Hey?
Are you going to say something?
No, I was just going to say scribble, scribble, scribble.
Oh, yeah.
It's a paper.
So, after the war ended, and you continued on in the military, did you know beforehand that you wanted to have a military career, or did that sort of just develop?
No, that developed while I was actually in the service. This is not true, because when I wanted to join up the Air Force as an aircraft apprentice, as they call it, as a boy service, that meant you would then go on to a regular engagement for service after you finish your boy service. So, yeah, I must have been thinking of a military career, even at that early stage, though I really hadn't planned that far ahead, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then during the war, particularly the latter part of the war, when I thought, well, I'm medically ground-graded for 12 months. Until I get upgraded, there's not much I can really do, because you can't join a service battalion unless you're fit. And at the end of 12 months, I'd been sent to Egypt, to one of our battalions in Egypt. But when I got there, all the draft went to the battalion. I wasn't allowed to go to the battalion because I wasn't medically fit. But I went and saw the MO and demanded the board, and I explained to the board, and they got medical documents, so you can't leave your medical documents around when you went from A to B, that this is a 12 months, considered to be a 12 months downgrading, presumably to let the old brain sort of relax and get back to square one again. And they agreed with me, and they reclassified me as fit A1, or it was known as FE then, which meant you're fit for service anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I was then shoved off to join the battalion. So I was able then to carry my military career through.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I actually signed on, while I was in Egypt, I actually signed on for my first regular stint,
mm-hmm.
which was 7 years. You signed up for 7 years with the colours and 5 years on the reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And then your next step, if you kept that on, was 12 years with the colours. And if you carried on for that, then you did 22 years of the colours. I never did the 12, I just went straight from the 7 on to the 22 years. By then I decided that's where I was going to stay.
And then during the war you were the rank of private, and then when did you work your way up to your rank as
when I was in Egypt and I got upgraded and I got sent to this battalion. Being all arrivals, were interviewed by the CO, quick short interview, but he said to me, an ex-paratrooper, been in the war? And I said, yeah, because all the other people that had been drafted at that stage were all people that had never been involved in the fighting. They were doing their training, they were in the army before the war ended, but they never. So, and he said, well, I'm in need of NCOs, and I'm sure an old paratrooper with war service will make a good Lance Corporal. So I said, well, I hope so, sir. So he said, right, we're running a card right now, a training card for NCOs, you will go on it. So I did, and I became a Lance Corporal. And that battalion, shortly after, was broke up and got sent back to England, except for people like me that had already signed on for regular engagement. The rest were all wartime wonders, you see. And we were then sent from Egypt to Tripoli, where the battalion that I stayed with them for more or less the rest of my service, the King's Royal Rifles, I got sent there. And a bit of luck there, because as a Lance Corporal, you only hold the rank at the sufferance of the CO. When we arrived, there were seven Lance Corporals amongst us. We were all told to take our stripes down, they were no longer needed. So I went to the company I was sent to, and the company's arm major sent me, oh, Lance Corporal, I need some Lance Corporals. I'm short of NCOs. And I said, well, we've just been told to take it down. You keep it up, I'll fix it with the company commander. And he did. So then I was a Lance Corporal. From Tripoli, we went to Palestine during the troubles in Palestine. And there I got promoted to full corporal, two stripes. Hey, doing well. When Palestine mandate, the British mandate in Palestine ended and Israel was formed, and they were fighting the Jews, fighting the Arabs like they've been doing ever since, the battalion once again was returned to the UK. And I was then posted what is known as extra regimental employment. They got a bunch of soldiers, they got the battalion broke up, so they got a bunch of soldiers they didn't know what to do with. So they sent us out to postings and all over the place. So I went to Austria and to a transit camp, troops coming into occupation troops in Austria. And I went there, and as I was versed in from a motorised unit and I was versed in vehicles, I was put on there in the motor transport platoon as MT corporal, motor transport corporal. Then the MT sergeant finished his time, he was a wartime NCO, got sent home, and I got promoted sergeant. Very nice. Acting sergeant, you have to be an acting sergeant for 6 months to become substantive sergeant. Now I could see this, this place packing units usefulness, and if I was to get posted I could lose this acting sergeant. So I then volunteered to go to Africa, to the King's African Rifles, as a sergeant. They took no rank lower than sergeant, no white rank lower than sergeant. So I volunteered to go there, and I ended up in Nyasaland, which I believe, I ended up in Northern Rhodesia, which I believe is now called Zaire. And I was there long enough to become a substantive sergeant. Then after a year there, we went to Malaya with this outfit and were jungle bashing in Malaya against the bandits in Malaya. All this adds up to all those medals I've got, you see. Every time you're declared on active service, you either get a medal or you get a bar to money for it exists. And from Malaya, I went back to England and bought myself a motorbike. I was made transport sergeant at my regimental depot. And with the motorbike, I toured around places in the south of England and eventually ran into once again a lady who became my wife. If I hadn't bought the motorbike, that would never have happened.
Yeah.
I got married there, then I got itchy feet again, and I looked around, and there was the Mau Mau uprising in Kenya. So I applied for a posting out there, took a trade test as a technical storm, sergeant technical storeman, which was a grade that was wanted, and I went to King's African Rifle Battalion in Kenya. The Elsie Battalion, most unhappy battalion as far as the whites were concerned. The CO was a drunkard, the RSM was a drunkard, who was only interested in his sycophants. But fortunately, the battalion was from Tanganyika, Dar es Salaam, and Tanganyika government, provincial government, colonial government decided they wanted them back after a stint, so they went back. I was surplus to establishment. They didn't have a tech sergeant down there. They looked around, and the Kenya battalion wanted us MT sergeant. Kenya battalion, King's African officer. I got posted to there. At that stage, I arranged for Rachel to come and join me, 6 months pregnant. And she came and joined me. We lived in a hotel for a while, and then we got a married quarter. And we had a daughter who turned out to be, we didn't know it until she was 6 months old, because they never told us, turned out to be Down syndrome. And if you don't know anything about Down syndrome, in those days it wasn't even known as Down syndrome, they called them mongoloid, mongol children. That's another story. And we had this daughter, who died just under 4 months later. So it was a rather eventful thing. Then I got smashed up in a motor accident, driver went to doze off, went to sleep or something. And I had a spell in military hospital there, then back up to the tower for a while, and then I got sent back to England for rehabilitation. This arm was, all I could do was that, I couldn't move the arm at all, it was frozen. And once again I had medical problems, I was unable to get promoted like I should have been, because I wasn't fit. Eventually I got myself fit, and I got promoted. I became a warrant officer class 2, and that made me surplus to establishment once again, so I was sent out to Singapore to the Gurkhas. You heard of Gurkha soldiers?
I have not.
Not heard of Gurkhas?
No.
See those knives up there? They carry a kukri. Now, ferocious little men who come from Nepal. Now, Nepalese in the army, they're known as Gurkhas.
Mm-hmm.
And they carry one of these, and they'll take your head clean off your shoulders with one of these.
Really? Wow. It's quite heavy.
Yeah. You need a bit of force if you're going to chop somebody's head off.
I guess so.
Now, what would you think that is for?
This little notch here?
Yeah. Not having a guess?
Breaking bones or something?
No, you're sort of a bit near it. A lot of people, particularly people at the handle weapons, look at it and think it's a sight, so they can throw it or something like that. But in actual fact, it is to make the blood drip off, not get on the handle, so that the handle becomes slippery and they can't hold it properly.
Oh.
Well thought out, eh?
Yeah, I guess so.
And there you have a sharpening steel and a skinning knife. Really, that they've got no real use. They're more ceremonial than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they did a lot of useful work in the desert, the Gurkhas, and when I joined them in Singapore, that was peacetime army, very pleasant. We all enjoyed it. And then trouble blew up in Brunei, North Borneo. And the Indonesians, there was a bit of a revolution in North Borneo, backed by the Indonesians, who then, the revolution collapsed when we went out there and collapsed it. And then the Indonesians decided to be a confrontation. They were sending regular troops across the border dressed as insurgents, mm-hmm. in uniform. But they were regular troops. And there was a little battle, a quiet little battle, which very rarely reached the headlines, but very few people, even in England, really knew about it. It was a quite little battle until in the end the Indonesians decided they'd had enough and came to an agreement to keep out of our area. So from there, I finished there. I came back home. Oh, while I was with the Gurkhas, I was an acting regimental sergeant major, RSM, warrant officer first class. Only acting because that last time I said I had more medical problems. Because I was downgraded and couldn't be promoted when I should have been, people on the regimental roll jumped over me. And at the stage I went to the Gurkhas, the position was for an RSM, but I had not a hope in hell of getting substantive because I was too far down the rolls then. Who'd been jumped over. One of those unfortunate happenings. But so I was RSM for 3 years, then back to England. I went to our territorial battalion, or militia as they're called here, as pay warrant officer. I used to requisition money, go to the bank and collect it, and then pay out the territorial soldiers when they'd done their training, or their weekend training, or their evening training. And I did that for 12 months, and then, or 18 months, I think, and then I went out of the army. I finished my time, 22 years now that I went.
Mm-hmm.
They gave me a lousy pension, and that was it. Yeah, I was getting £16 a month at a time when it was $4 to the pound. So yeah. I wasn't getting a lot of money a month.
Mm-hmm.
But that was it. That was, we all knew what it was when we took on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was the end of my military career.
And then when did you make it out to Canada? When did you move out here?
Oh, I never wanted to settle in England. From the time I first left England, I didn't want to settle there. There were better places to live. And when I was in Singapore, I had arranged with the RAF, they ran
an aircraft over to Sydney in Australia once a month. And I don't really know what for, but they'd arranged this, and I got onto it, and I'd arranged to get a lift over to Sydney to have a look at the place, and with the view to migrating to Australia. Mm-hmm. However, this trouble in Brunei and North Borneo blew up, and I never got my ride to Australia. I got sent to North Borneo instead. So I made tentative approaches to Australia House in England, and I sent them references and things like that. And I've been accepted to go to Oz as an immigrant from England when I finished my service. I was still serving while it was going on. And Rachel didn't want to go. She said, well, can't we try England? All right, if you wish. So I dropped that. And I got a very good job in England. I did exceedingly well. I went back to school, went to college. I became a member of the Institute of Works Managers. And in 5 years, the people I was working for when I joined, it was a firm called Lister Diesel, Listers, that made diesel engines, industrial and marine diesel engines. In 5 years, the people that I was working for when I joined, they were working for me. But my neighbour and good friend, 20 years younger than me actually, but he became a good friend who lived opposite me where we were living then. He migrated to Canada. He got relatives out here to help him settle in. And he was writing me glowing letters about Canada, and John, you should come out here, it's a great place. And I got itchy feet once again, and I said to Rachel, I've had enough of England, dear, we're going to set up and go. She didn't want to come, but she said, if that's what you want, we'll go. So, we sold up everything. I got a new car, which is only 3 months old. I sold it to my next door neighbour for the price I wanted. He was very happy to get it cheaper than if he'd have bought a brand new one. He was looking at buying a new car. Another army friend of mine from Kenya days, who'd been living in Bermuda, had come home to resettle in England, and he wanted to settle in the area where I was living, and I was able to sell him my house with half the furniture, just like that. It all fell in nicely. I came out here to Canada, where my friend had arranged accommodation for me, I think, and another had settled down. And you know Eaton's, I'm sure. He was a department manager in Eaton's, and I got a job in town. This was in Mission. I got a job in Mission down on the flats of Chapel. The big barn our place was building prefab houses. I got a job there, which turned me in good stead. And I learned how to build a Canadian house, wire it, plumb it. And then Steve got posted over here. And I found, I got fed up with the boss. He was a nice bloke, but I got fed up with his attitude. And we had words, and I had packed in working for him. And at that stage, Eaton's in Mission were in need of a janitor, of all things. So it's a job. It's going to earn me money. So I took the job as a janitor with Eaton's. And 3 months later, Steve got posted over here to Duncan. And I found that they were having a job to find a replacement for him. So I applied for the job. I went for an interview and gave him my management credentials and experience. Though I'd got no retail experience, I was well-versed in management of one form or another, and they accepted me for the post. So I went back to Mission, and the following day, the branch store's manager came up. And there I'm in my janitor's uniform, and he gathered my department staff together and said, this is your new manager. Which shocked a few of them. But at any rate, so 12 months later, they built a brand new store in Abbotsford, Seven Oaks, and shut down Mission. And the manager of Seven Oaks chose his own management staff, which didn't include me. He chose me from around the province. So I was over there, and I was... the assistant manager said, I can offer you two jobs. You can either take over shipping and receiving, or you can take over the maintenance of the building. So I said, I'll do the maintenance. I'm versed in plumbing and electrical work, so I'll take that job on. And he said, well, you'll retain your management privileges for 12 months, making a posting to one of the other branch stores when there's a vacancy. So I said, oh, fair dues. So I started on this. And the first payday, I found I got too much money. So I went and saw the personnel manageress, and she said, oh, no, while you're working industrial staff, you're getting paid the rate for the job. And because Eaton don't want to get unions in here, all the industrial staff are paid better than the sale of the retail staff. So I said, good ho, forget all the management stuff, I'll stay in this job.
Yeah.
So I stayed there for 18 years, doing all the maintenance on the building. In actual fact, I did, before I finished, I did a lot more. I took over a lot of the display work, the building display things and that, and I quite enjoyed working there, and eventually they cut down on management, and the store manager lost his assistant manager. And he was an ex-serviceman like myself, wartime, he didn't turn after war, but he came to me and he said, look, I can't cope with all this, I want somebody to help me out. So I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I want you to run somebody to run the janitorial staff and the shipping and receiving, or keep your eye on them. And so I said, well, I don't mind. He said, no, pay for the job. I said, well, that's all right. I'm used to being in a supervisory position. So there I was supervising, I was hiring and firing, I was writing confidential annual confidential reports, and all I was a maintenance man.
Yeah.
Quite a good position. That's how I enjoyed the time there.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was 65, your retirement date was supposed to be the last day of the month in which you were 65. So on my birthday was the 1st of June, so that meant 30th of June was my official retirement day. But on the 1st of June, I went in there all dressed up, said, I'm not going to bloody work, I'm retired, that's it, goodbye everybody. And I had a couple of weeks' holiday, which I was credited with, and the other last 2 days of the month I was noted as absent. But I was ready to retire. And like so many people that don't know what they're going to do when they retire, I didn't know what the hell I was going to do when I retired, but I was ready to retire. I had enough of working for a living.
Yeah.
And so I retired.
Mm-hmm.
Then we were living in Mission. We lived there for 18 years, where I arrived when I came to Kenya, and that's where I stayed. And then one son stayed in England, never came out here. The other son's out here. He moved to the island. We had one daughter and another one on the way. And that was it for Rachel. She wanted to be where the grandkids were.
Mm-hmm.
So we came over here, looked around, spotted this house, bought it. Boyce was living in Royston at the time. And everything in the garden was lovely. Rachel had her two grandkids, and I had my son and his wife. I wasn't all that stuck on his wife, but really, she wasn't too bad. And then all of a sudden, about 6 months ago, I don't know why, my son decided he didn't want to know anything about his parents anymore. And he said, get lost, and we've not heard from him since. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I'm not really bothered. If he wants to play silly buggers, that's his. So that brings us up to date.
Yeah. Wow.
We still got the grandchildren from visitors.
Yeah.
And please, Rachel.
Yeah.
The courtly taxi to it, lady.
Quite a career.
Yeah, varied, if nothing else.
Yeah, exactly. So I just have a couple more questions.
Good.
Here. Going back to the war, when you think back on your experience during the war, is there something prominent or sort of the first thing that comes to your mind when you think of the war and your experience there?
One thing that came out of D-Day, which bothered me for many years, was... You've read about it in my diary, Chap Mortimer. He got no recognition, and I felt he should have done. His people probably never knew. Well, I know they didn't know the way he died. But it wasn't until we got onto computers, and I got onto Pine Coffin's grandson, and he started making inquiries for me, and he found Mortimer's descendants. And I wrote to them and told them all about what I consider Mortimer's heroic death. I've got a cutting downstairs on the computer from his people. It was I got onto the local newspaper and showed him my letter and told him all of the ideas, and a picture of Mortimer and his heroic hatchet was published in their local paper in Devonshire. And when I think about D-Day, that's one of the first things that comes to mind, and I was so pleased that I was able to
Excuse me. For the first time I get emotional about it. I'm so pleased I was able to contact his descendants, not his mum and dad, of course, were no longer there, but his descendants, and let them know what a character he had been, mm-hmm. how heroic he was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the first thing that comes to my mind when I think about D-Day and the war.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful that you helped him become remembered, because, you know, if people like that hadn't done what they did, I might not be living in the world I'm living in.
Yeah, that's true.
So, and then finally, is there a particular way that you want to be remembered for what you did over there?
No, I was just a number doing a job.
Yeah.
No. I've left instructions that when I die and I'm cremated, hopefully before my wife, she's 6 years younger than me, that on the cemetery at Cumberland, there is a little, I forget what they call it now, if you go up there, you can see it at the back of the cemetery thing, and it's a succession of literally boxes, put the ashes in and a memoriam. And I'd just like to leave a message to show that I was here sometime during my life, not just ashes scattered to the wind and gone and forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's about it. Otherwise, I think nothing of particular value of my existence. I've had an interesting life. I've enjoyed my life. I was lucky during the war that I was not killed or maimed worse than I was. And I got a great wife who's been a great supporter to me in all my married career. Even when I got smashed up in that motor accident and I was carted back to town, to the hospital, I got out of the Land Rover and I'm all bandaged up round here and hanging onto this arm and I'm dripping blood, and I walk along this pathway and I saw this pair of black shoes and I recognised them as Rachel's, and I said, never did trust bloody African drivers, and she stood there laughing her head off. Just pure relief, you know, but I pulled her leg a lot about that. I was all in this state and all you could do was laugh.
Yeah.
So there we go. When you finish, we'll go downstairs and there's these, I'll show you these CDs I've got.
Okay.
Get you a run through them and then I'll give you the CDs.
Sure.
Anything else now?
I think that's everything that I have here. So thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me. And it was very interesting. I learned a lot and I have lots to think about now. And so thank you very much.
You're very welcome. I must say, I've gotten to be done to a more charming person.
Oh, thank you. All right. I'll shut this off.